Good afternoon and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us from the Sun Lake Splash, Low Maintenance, Water Wise by Danette Hunnell. The lantana is a low-maintenance, water-wise, long-lasting, shrub-like plant with constant color. Plant lantanas now so they are well-established by summer. Lantanas come in many different colors and styles. Before planting, consider the spot for the new lantana as they can spread in different ways depending on the varietal. Trailing, which is low-growing. The stick-like stems attach themselves to the ground. The mounding, which grows up to approximately 12 to 15 inches tall and 3.5 feet wide, and a lantana bush, 4 feet tall by 4 feet wide, and can be shaped to either a ball or mound, upright or square. Small clusters of flowers bloom freely throughout the plant all year long. Lantanas have a fragrance defined as a citrus sage scent. These plants are toxic, so always wash your hands. The lantana leaves are scratchy, and the stick-like stems have stickers, so wear gloves. They do get tiny, dark blue berries, which dry up and go away with pruning. Newly planted lantanas need to be kept moist for the first few days so that roots spread into the surrounding soil. Then, a slow, deep watering weekly so their roots go deeper throughout the dry summer. Ramp watering back down in the late fall. An occasional hose spray to feed the leaves is recommended. If your lantana is well established and healthy, it will do fine for a few weeks for your short summer absences. Lantanas are repellent to rabbits, so they are perfect protection around your veggies or flowers. These lovely plants have an extensive root system to capture moisture, but they won't take over your water pipes or other plants. Therefore, in the future, if needed, they may be moved and/or transplanted in your yard, or if necessary, completely removed. Lantanas may remain green and bloom year-round, but on those 4 or 5 cold nights, cover with a sheet or burlap until the sun comes up. Also, giving them a short drink at sundown keeps them a bit warmer under their blanket. Lantanas also create their own insulating mulch via leaf drop for warmth and moisture. Lantanas require a little fertilizer. If the plant looks a little blah after monsoon season, a layer of pine needles gathered from littering trees will increase the acidity. Leave needles for 2 months to make your lantana happy. Occasionally, lantanas go semi-dormant, losing their leaves and delay flowering until wetter, cooler days return, but it's nothing to worry about. Prune and/or shape lantanas periodically by lightly shearing the tip growth and across the top. Because it is stick-like underneath, it discourages critters from nibbling, but they are prone to pesky white flies. Use neem oil on the underside of the leaves in the morning or evening when it's cooler. Lantanas are a favorite of butterflies, bees, and hummingbirds. If you see these three frequently floating in your yard, then you'll know your lantanas are healthy. Spring Refresh, Plan Ahead to Help Your Lawn Survive Summer by Mike Hogan. With the arrival of spring, it will soon be time to provide some TLC to your lawn so it greens up quickly and is able to survive the challenging conditions of summer heat and reduced levels of soil moisture. Too often, homeowners don't begin needed lawn maintenance until later in the season, after the spring flush of grass growth and the lawn has been mowed several times. Depending on the weather, late spring may be beyond the optimal time to complete lawn maintenance tasks such as fertilizer application, weed control, and reseeding bare spots. While we associate turf grass growth and lawn maintenance with summer months, turf grasses are perennial cool season plants, which means that they are plants which come back year after year and they grow best in the cooler, more moist conditions of spring, fall, and sometimes winter. Summer, with its hot and many times dry weather, is actually a period of stress for turf grasses, which requires us to give extra attention to lawn maintenance in early spring if we expect the grass stand to survive the challenging conditions of summer. Apply needed nutrients. To green up in early spring and develop adequate root systems which can survive the season, turf grasses require adequate amounts of three soil nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Nitrogen does not persist in the soil and must be applied to the lawn each year to stimulate growth and meet the nutritional needs of grass plants. Phosphorus and potassium are stored in the soil from year to year, and some lawns do not require yearly applications of these two nutrients. The only way to know exactly how much fertilizer your lawn needs this year is to have a soil test done. When applying soil fertilizer, only use the amount recommended by a soil test, and be sure that fertilizer is not accidentally spread on paved driveways, sidewalks, or streets where it can be washed into storm sewers and end up in surface waters such as streams and lakes, where it contributes to harmful algal blooms. Never too early to reseed. If the lawn has bare spots or a thinning stand, reseeding should be completed in early spring. As the lawn begins to green up, before the first mowing of the season, walk the lawn and take a critical look for the presence of bare spots or thinning areas and apply seed where needed. If spring rains are infrequent and spring weather is unusually warm, be sure to provide supplemental irrigation to the newly seeded areas even in early April. Resist the temptation to overmulch newly seeded areas with straw. If large areas of the lawn need to be reseeded or you wish to renovate the entire lawn with a completely new seeding, late summer and early fall may be a better time for reseeding. Grass seedlings, which emerge from late summer or fall seeding, tend to be more successful because they have two cool seasons, fall and winter, to develop root systems before they are exposed to the hot and dry conditions of late spring and summer. Control weeds before they emerge. The easiest time to control weeds in the lawn is before they emerge, so if your lawn contained an abundance of weeds, such as dandelion, plantain, ground ivy, or any other broadleaf weed last season, applying a pre-emergent herbicide early this spring can reduce the number of weeds in the lawn this season. A pre-emergent herbicide is a chemical which prevents seeds from germinating, so do not apply these products to recently reseeded areas of the lawn. If your lawn was infested with crabgrass last summer, spring will be a good time to apply a pre-emergent herbicide designed to prevent crabgrass emergence. Most products which provide crabgrass control require a soil temperature of at least 55 degrees Fahrenheit for maximum effectiveness. A useful phenological rule of thumb for timing crabgrass control products is to apply them when a forsythia begins to bloom. From the April-May issue of Phoenix Home & Garden magazine, Labor of Love, a carefree couple's landscape is still evolving years after they planted the first of the hundreds of specimens on their two-acre paradise by Paula M. Boda. The backyard view to Pinnacle Peak was the reason Tammy Moorer and Brad Chapman bought their carefree house in 2009 when they moved to the valley from Nebraska. That the almost 2 acres of gardens had been long neglected and were overgrown with brittlebush didn't deter the couple. When I lived in Nebraska, I enjoyed being outdoors and doing landscaping, Brad says. And as a member of the board of Omaha's renowned Lauritsen Gardens, he had more than a passing familiarity with things botanical. For her part, Tammy grew up on a Nebraska farm, so she was no stranger to working with the land. The duo dug into what has become a continual work in progress, transforming all their property into a botanical wonderland that celebrates all the flora of the desert. It all looks so well planned, this series of garden spaces featuring cacti and succulents of almost every variety, gathered in amiable clusters or marching along the gravel walkways that tie everything together. Yet Brad confesses they never sat down and created a master plan. A lot of the planning involved sitting, maybe drinking a margarita, and just looking, he says. Mostly the couple went to plant nurseries throughout the valley, looking for specimens that caught their fancy. I have a bad habit of wandering through Home Depot's garden section and buying things that I think look neat, then losing the tag so I have no idea what it is or how big it'll get, Brad says. Their first move is to create a welcoming entrance to the property with a long driveway that ends in a circle of concrete and brick, cut and stained to resemble the sun's rays. Paths of pavers and gravel wind from the driveway in a walkway that meanders around the house through a series of garden rooms, each with its own set of delights. We have so many different spaces, we've given them names, Tammy says. The veranda garden sits off the back of the home, where a spacious terrace overlooks the swimming pool and the view of Pinnacle Peak to the south. The couple opened up the home by replacing a wall with a 24-foot-long slider system that enhances the indoor-outdoor connection. An entertaining area includes an outdoor bar with rustic wooden pergolas designed by Tammy. At the far end of the pool, a waterfall cascades down a wall of rocks, and in garden beds around the perimeter, Brad and Tammy install plants, tall and short, spiky and mounded, in a variety of colors and textures, including Mexican fence post, blue agave, and golden barrel cactus. Off to one side of the pool is a shady area with a tiny lawn of artificial turf where the couple exchanged wedding vows in 2011. Among their favorite plants is a euphorbia, a succulent they planted early on that has grown so tall it has joined the canopy of trees that shade this part of the garden. "It's so happy here," Tammy says. "Every now and then they'll cut a piece of it off and plant it elsewhere. Now we have a whole family of euphorbia," she says. The Spanish garden sits off the main kitchen on the west side of the house. The couple forged a connection to the outdoors here, too, expanding the kitchen and adding a large slider that adds to a new patio whose tile is a continuation of the kitchen floor. Here, the couple might enjoy morning coffee or a pre-dinner cocktail while gazing at the fire pit backed with paradise blue stone. The stone, from fist-sized to boulders, is scattered throughout the property, bringing year-round color, even in months when not much is blooming. This part of the yard slopes steeply, so a system of retaining walls was built, resulting in a more walkable space with a series of terraces and beds that Brad and Tammy have planted with more varieties of plants. Brad, who grew up in Montana, says, "I wanted to plant things I couldn't grow in Montana, including lots of limes for margaritas." In addition to the lime trees, the orchard garden holds lemons, oranges, grapefruit, guava, artichoke, pomegranate, dragon fruit, and new to the experiment, an avocado tree. "The dragon fruit has yet to give us anything," Brad says. "I'll have to talk to it." The couple tries to stick to plants that are indigenous to the Southwest, but now and then, nature plays a trick. "We weren't going to have a palm tree because they're not native," Tammy says. "But then this little thing popped up out of the ground and we said, well, let's see what it is. It turned out to be a palm tree. Native or not, the palm seems right at home among the mesquite and Palo Verde trees that are more typical of this part of the world." Adding to the visual and textural interest of the hundreds of varieties of plants in the ground are the specimens that grow in the colorful pots that punctuate the landscape. "I put things in pots and schlep them around," Tammy explains. "Then, when they get big enough, they get transplanted somewhere in the gardens." Supplementing it all are the treasures Tammy finds at shops in the valley. Rusted metal sculptures, an old wooden wagon, a vintage cowboy boot, and any number of stars and angels are tucked in among the plantings. The yard that gives them such pleasure is an ongoing work in progress. "It's living art," Brad says. "It constantly evolves as we live in it and experience it. It's so fun to stand back and watch how it's changed over time," Tammy adds. "Nature in the desert is phenomenal." From BetterHomesAndGardens.com, 6 simple ways to get rid of weeds in your driveway cracks, according to experts. Stop pesky weeds from growing in your driveway cracks for good with these expert tips by Lauren David. Weeds can be described as any plant that's growing where you don't want it. And a plant sprouting out of the cracks in your driveway certainly is not where you'd want it. The narrow space can make it challenging to remove and prevent weeds, but there are a few different options for dealing with the problem. Here's how to get rid of weeds growing in your driveway cracks, according to experts. First, seal driveway cracks. Driveway cracks can provide just enough access to soil to allow weed seeds to sprout. Once cracks are present, there's nothing that can be done to prevent weeds other than resealing the cracks, says Brad Fowler, Urban Horticulture Extension Agent, Horry in Georgetown County's Clemson Extension. Repairing a driveway crack is the best way to stop unwanted plants from growing. In order to do so, clean out the cracks of all soil and seal them using a flexible concrete caulk, says Noel Johnson, horticulturalist and author of The Water Smart Garden. According to Fowler, there are concrete sealants, caulks, and even something called polymeric sand that is used to fill in cracks between pavers. Polymeric sand may not be the best option for concrete driveways, he says, because the sand color may not match the color of the concrete driveway. Secondly, remove by hand. One of the best methods for stopping different types of weeds from growing is pulling them up by the roots. Use a knife or a sharp hook tool, advises Fowler. Johnson recommends removing weeds after it's rained so they're easier to pull out. Use a screwdriver to help dislodge the weed along with its roots, she says. Third, pour boiling water. Pouring boiling water over weeds can help kill them but may require several applications. Boiling water may burn the top of the weed and suppress it for a time, but it's not normally going to kill the weed all the way to the roots, says Fowler. As long as the roots are in the ground, weeds will continue to grow back. You may need to repeat this a week later, as the roots may not be killed with the first application, says Johnson. Fowler doesn't recommend this method because of the safety concerns of injuring oneself in the process. Fourth, spray with water. Blasting weeds in driveway cracks with a strong stream of water can help. Use a pressure washer or a hose to remove the soil from the cracks so weeds can't germinate, says Johnson. This method may also help loosen the soil along with any weeds that are growing. The strong stream of water from a pressure washer will at times dislodge the weed or at the very least cut it off below the surface of the crack, says Fowler. Fifth, use fire. Another option for removing unwanted plants from your driveway is to burn the weeds using a propane weed torch, says Johnson. However, the heat from the fire can discolor hard surfaces, so this may not be the best option to stop weeds. Because of safety concerns and the risk of discoloring the hard surface, it isn't something I would recommend, says Fowler. Take safety precautions and wear safety gear if you choose to eliminate weeds with fire. And number 6, spot treat with herbicide. Applying a weed killer is an option if other methods don't work. One of the most viable ways to stop weeds once they've started growing in cracks are chemicals, says Fowler. If weeds have grown in the driveway cracks in previous seasons and haven't sprouted yet, opt for a pre-emergent weed killer. This is used before the weeds begin to grow. Apply a pre-emergent herbicide along the driveway cracks to prevent the weeds from coming up, says Johnson. Weeds that are already growing will require a different weed killer or herbicide. Choose the correct herbicide to get rid of the weeds and always follow the instructions on the label exactly. Here's an article that appeared recently in the Arizona Republic, "Are Arizona Paper Wasps Dangerous?" by Tiffany Acosta. What's buzzing around Arizona? It's not bees or mosquitoes, it's wasps. Active year-round, wasps are most noticeable during the summer months, particularly from June through September. This peak season sees their colonies at full size, leading to increased foraging behavior around food sources. Arizona's warm climate supports a lengthy wasp season, with common species including yellow jackets, paper wasps, and hornets. During these months, wasps are more prevalent, making it essential to exercise caution around their nests and manage potential attractants. According to Todd Schlenke, an associate professor of entomology at the University of Arizona, wasps are closest relatives with ants and bees. Unlike bees, which are typically fatter and fuzzier, wasps have a distinctive hourglass shape with a very thin waist where the thorax and abdomen meet. This unique body structure differentiates them from their relatives and underscores their distinct appearance and behavior in Arizona's ecosystem. Here's everything you need to know about wasps in Arizona. What kind of wasps live in Arizona? Well, Arizona is home to a variety of wasp species. Some of the most common types include paper wasps. These wasps are often seen building umbrella-shaped nests under eaves, in attics, or in other sheltered areas. They have slender bodies with long legs and are typically brown with yellow or red markings. I feel like definitely the paper wasps are the ones that a lot of people are looking up for. They're the most common here in Arizona, says Schlenke. Yellow jackets. These wasps are more aggressive and can be a nuisance, especially around food and garbage. They have stout bodies with black and yellow markings. Mud daubers. These solitary wasps build nests out of mud, often on walls or in sheltered areas. They have long, slender bodies and are usually black or metallic blue. Cicada killers. These are large wasps that dig burrows in the ground. They are known for their size and for preying on cicadas. They have reddish and black bodies with yellow markings. Tarantula hawks. These are very large wasps with metallic blue-black bodies and bright orange wings. They're known for their painful stings and their behavior of hunting tarantulas. They're really big, and they're black and shiny, and they grab tarantulas and lay their eggs inside tarantulas, and the babies basically eat them from the inside out, says Schlenke. Velvet ants. Despite their name, velvet ants are actually wasps. The females are wingless and covered in dense hair, often brightly colored in red, orange, or yellow. And those of you who are regular listeners to this show know we feature stories each week from the terrific book called Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. This story is called An American Beauty. It was written by Arlene Westhouse. And there's a quote here from Malachi 2:10. Have we not all one Father? Hath not one God created us? An American Beauty. In the 1930s, after the death of her husband, a middle-aged woman named Marguerite left Germany to make a new life in America, away from Hitler and the Third Reich. Marguerite's younger brother, Wilhelm, stayed behind with his Jewish wife and family to protect their assets, unaware of the horrors to come. In her adopted country, Marguerite lived on a small pension and supplemented her income by raising a variety of roses, which she sold to local florists and hospitals. She sent some of the earnings from her roses to help support her brother in Germany. And as the war advanced, she also sent money to help Jews escape from Germany. Marguerite's neighbors viewed her as a quiet, unassuming woman who spent most days in her garden or greenhouse. Not much was known about her, nor did the community try to befriend the foreign-born woman. But when the U.S. entered the war against Germany, Marguerite became suspect. While her neighbors and shopkeepers had never been friendly or particularly kind, they were now openly hostile. There were mutters and whispers about her being a Nazi, always just loud enough for her to hear. Without fanfare, Marguerite continued to send money to Jewish families and to her brother in Germany. And then, one day, she received a letter from her sister-in-law with devastating news. Her beloved Wilhelm was dying of cancer. He was praying for a miracle to be able to come to the U.S. where he could receive better medical care. At first, Marguerite was panic-stricken. She didn't have the extra money. But soon, she was overjoyed when a hospital requested an unusually large order of roses. This was the extra income she needed to make the miracle happen. For weeks, she tended her roses, nurturing and fertilizing them with tender care. Each rose meant another dollar to help bring Wilhelm to America. In August, Marguerite entered a local contest for the most beautiful roses grown. If she won, the prize money of $25 would ease her financial burden when Wilhelm and his family arrived. On the day of the festival, she rose early to cut the flowers before they were wilted by the sun. As she stepped into the garden, she nearly fell to her knees with shock. All 100 rose bushes, lovingly planted and nurtured over the last 7 years, lay in shambles before her. Every plant was slashed and chopped to the ground. They all but bled before her eyes. She could barely take it in. Her beloved flowers and her livelihood gone, possibly forever. And the worst of it was that Wilhelm would not be able to come to America. Marguerite was devastated, but more determined than ever to show up at the festival. She would not give the hooligans the satisfaction of her absence. She would still enter the contest, even if they had left but a petal. She walked down the garden path to see if she could salvage anything from the debris. Clinging to life by the back fence, obviously missed by the vandals, was one single red rose. It was an American beauty. She took the rose into the house, cut the stem on an angle, and placed it in the icebox to keep it fresh until the contest. And then, shaking with distress, she cleaned up the ruined rose garden as best she could. When she could do no more, she put on her best hat and took a trolley to the contest, holding the lone rose in her hand. When Marguerite's turn came to show her entry, she held up her single American beauty. In her halting English, she proudly described its origin, how she had bred it, and the special fertilizer she had used to enhance the color of its petals. But when the winners were announced, she wasn't surprised at the absence of her name. Why would they give the prize to a rose from the garden of the enemy? She went home that evening trying to think of some other way she could earn money. The next day, Marguerite attended church, as was her custom, to pray for strength and guidance. When she arrived home and opened the door, the scent of flowers filled the air. Someone had placed a large vase filled with summer flowers on the entryway table. As she walked toward the kitchen, she saw that every room in her home had more bouquets of flowers in mason jars and pitchers. It was heavenly. As she approached the kitchen, she saw a fresh coffee cake in the middle of the table. Under the cake plate was an envelope addressed to Marguerite. She opened it to find $300 in single bills and a card that simply said, "Many thanks from your friends in town." Stunned and happy, Marguerite realized this was the miracle Wilhelm had been praying for, and now she could bring him to America. The miracle did come to pass. With the $300, Marguerite bought steamship tickets. Within a few months, Wilhelm and his family arrived. Marguerite and his wife cared for him tenderly, and he received excellent medical attention that added years to his life. For years, Marguerite tried to discover who her benefactors were, but without success. Many years later, a local woman was going through the personal effects of her late grandfather, who had been a cantor in the local synagogue. She found his journal, and in it, an entry of particular interest. The journal stated while attending the Rose Festival, the cantor had overheard two men in the audience brag about ripping up the Nazis' rose bushes. He knew who they meant. Marguerite had never sought recognition for her charity, but many Jews in the community knew that her roses helped Jewish families escape the nightmare of the Holocaust. That day, the cantor set about calling on members of his synagogue, explaining about the vandalism and the financial loss Marguerite had suffered. The men and women in the synagogue gave with their hearts and pocketbooks to the Rose Lady. Several women who shared Marguerite's love of gardening gathered flowers from their own gardens to honor her for all she had done for their people. Rather than have her feel an obligation, they took an oath to remain anonymous until death. They all kept the promise. With patient love and care, Marguerite's roses bloomed again, and Marguerite bloomed as well. She made many friends in town over the years following the war, never knowing that many of them were her secret benefactors, and she continued to send money to Germany to help Jewish families until her death in 1955. That's called An American Beauty, written by Arlene Westhouse, one of the many stories that make up chicken soup for the garter soul. And that's the Green Thumb Show for this week for Sun Sounds Radio. I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Be safe and healthy. And we'll be talking with you soon.